Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In a new book called Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names, Joshua Jelly Shapiro writes, "Place names can bind people together or keep them apart. They can encode history and signal mores. They can proclaim what a culture venerates at one moment in time and serve as vessels for how it evolves and shifts later on. Gettysburg, Attica, Stonewall, Rome, Wall Street, Main Street, Alabama, Prague, Malibu, Beirut, Boca Raton. Place names can summon worlds and evoke epochs in just a few syllables. They can recall long-ago events or become, as settings for more recent ones, metonyms for historical change." In the book, Joshua explores the power of names and how they continue to shape New York's identity today. He has two virtual events at Greenlight Bookstore on April 19th at 7:30 p.m. and live from the New York Public Library April 21st at 8 p.m. But he is with us right now. Joshua Jelly Shapiro, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, listeners, get in on this conversation. How much do you know about the names of New York? Your public radio listeners, I think you might know a few things. Do you know the origin story of a specific street or neighborhood name? Or maybe you have a question for Joshua. Get in on this conversation by calling 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. Joshua, you write at the beginning of the book that toponymy, the study of place names, isn't a well-known field. How did you become interested in it?
Yes, well, I'm a geographer by training. I went to graduate school and did a degree in geography, but I have worked for many years as a writer. So, words about place names, which combine my two loves, love for place, thinking about place, and a love for language as a writer, it kind of brings these things together. So I've always been fascinated just by the language that we lend to landscape, the words that we use to navigate our days. And this is a book really that I wanted to write for some time and finally got the chance to do so starting a couple of years ago.
When you think about New York, what's unique about its toponymy?
Yes, well, a couple things are unique. I mean, one of those things is obviously every place has its own history. In New York, the layers of history that are sort of there to be uncovered are indigenous history, the Lenape. Many of our place names from Manhattan down, of course, come from New York's First Peoples. And you have the Dutch, many of those names, and then the English, and then on down to today, right? It's interesting, though, thinking about New York as opposed to, for example, cities or places in the so-called Old World in Europe, where sometimes you have to go back centuries and millennia, and you're moving through many, many different languages and peoples who've shaped the landscape and had different words. So it can be a real, task of detection to figure out, where even the word York, for example, comes from, which we can talk about. But in New York, like many places in the New World, so-called, right, those layers are there to be uncovered. And so you can sort of get down to the actual story of where names come from and how and where they were left by the people who coined them.
You write something in the book that I think is really interesting because it sounds like it's simple, but I don't think it is. You write that names matter more, even more, when they're attached to places.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm saying there is that I think in the beginning of the book, I talk about how all of us, obviously, names matter. They matter. Anyone who's had a kid and had to figure out what to call that kid knows that names feel important. Those of us who change our names, right, know that names are vitally important to our sense of self and who we are and what we want to do and be. But the reason I have that line in the book about how place names are uniquely important is just the ways in which they often come to be by happenstance. Some random person, say, or some Dutch settler, wandering around Upper Manhattan decides that this marshy landscape, reminds him of home and the village of Harlem, calls it Harlem. quite by accident, as I say. And then a place name like that can sort of stick around for centuries. And obviously today, a place name like Harlem has become symbolic and iconic of other things, not of a village in Holland, but of Black freedom and pride and culture because of the people who have moved to that place and sort of made it their own over the last century and more. And so I'm fascinated just by the ways in which place names, as I say, can come to be by accident or by people in power sort of placing them on maps or on the landscape. But because they tend to stick around for a long time, certainly longer than an individual human life or the life of whoever coined the place name in question, they can take on new meanings and have new meanings attached to them. And I find that fascinating about place names. And of course, there are examples all across the city of ways in which that's happened, whether they're Dutch or English or a Dutch name that became an English name or a name that becomes sung about in songs, you know, whether that's 4th Street or crossing 110th Street or any number of songs, right? 53rd and 3rd, the Ramon song. These place names, even simple ones that are just numbers on the grid, take on new meanings. And I'm fascinated by how and why that happens.
My guest is Joshua Jelly Shapiro. The name of the book is Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names. You write about what you call, quote, the slow genocide of America's indigenous population between 1492 and the American Revolution, and that led to the loss of millions of words and dialects that, you know, will never really recover. But let's start with one of the first words from indigenous language that was adopted by colonizing Europeans, Manhattan.
Yes, absolutely. And Manhattan, it's interesting. It's obviously, this is the native place name that we know best in New York City, although there are many, right? Especially you go over to New Jersey and you have Hackensack and Hoboken and mm-hmm. Passaic, and in Brooklyn you have Rockaway and you have Gowanus, and you have, you know, there are many, many native place names, of course. But yes, Manhattan, which comes from Manhattan, which is essentially derives from one of Henry Hudson's seamen in 1609, writing that word down in his log and saying the native people here seem to call this side of the river Manhattan, and it appeared on another map around the same time. So it's slightly mysterious sort of exactly what he heard. And linguists and philologists have debated this actually for centuries. One back in the 19th century, a professor called Mr. Heckewelder, I believe, in 1822, said that Manhattan meant place where we all became intoxicated, which was popular at the time, though that was later discredited. A later translation said it meant island of hills, and that became popular. But our best guess at now from actual linguists and activists and culture bearers who speak Lenape is that most likely the word referred to place where we gather wood for bows and arrows. And because Manhattan at that time there were hard ash trees and hickory trees, and it seems that it was a place that was used for that. But the interesting thing I think about that, right, is that this, again, is a kind of happenstantial thing, that this sailor on Henry Hudson's boat perhaps hears this word, writes it down. And in the sort of European or Dutch worldview, you know, they needed a name to attach to this place. And they took that name and kind of recast it and made it Manhattan. And it lasts to this day. But again, this is a sort of dynamic that we see repeated again and again, where many colonists sort of like the idea of naming this new and wild world, this new place, for words that were used or at least sounded like they were used in the languages of indigenous people. You know, in the United States, we have no fewer than 26 states which have names which are of Native American origin, or at least pretend to be. Idaho, for example, was someone that sort of huckster who coined that word. Said it was a Shoshone word, but it's not, in fact. But I think that what that signifies, right, is that there's this interesting dynamic where colonists and sort of in the history of America, reaching right up to the present in certain ways, there's an appeal to the sort of language of those who came before that goes alongside in a kind of, you know, twisted and upsetting way, with the will to kind of push those people off the land. But we see that again and again, and it's fascinating to sort of dig into those stories and understand how they happened, but also to dig into the stories of what became of those people. And one of the things that I do in this book, and I've had the pleasure of kind of engaging and exploring over the last couple of years, is the community of people, of Lenape people, who absolutely are still here. Many of their descendants, right, live in Oklahoma or Ontario mm-hmm. at present. But there's a woman called Karen Hunter who teaches Lenape language classes at the Endangered Language Alliance, which is a marvelous small organization in Manhattan, not far from Union Square. And so there are sort of ways to learn and engage this history, even if many of the people, the first peoples of New York, are not in this area anymore, though there are some. It's important to emphasize that. But those histories are there to be engaged and thought through, and I think it behooves us all to do so and to understand that history.
Well, our phone lines are full, Joshua, so let's take some calls. You'll do your best to answer. And like I said, a lot of our listeners know a lot of things. So let's check.
Sure.
Yeah, let's check in with Elliot on line two. Hi, Elliot. Thanks for calling All of It.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Allison. First, a little bitty fact. There's a street up a little bit north of Barnard College called Moylan Place. M-O-Y-L-A-N. It's not a street. It's just a street sign. There used to be a street there, apparently. But I guess this guy, whoever he was so important that they had to leave the sign. And we also, so if you can tell me about that, that's great. I also would love to know who LaSalle Street and Tienen Place are named for. And if you have time, there's a street a little bit up right in Harlem. Harlem, of course, which was named because nobody asked for it to be named that. Anyway, there's a street called Hangover Street. I hope it's a typo and it's Hanover, but I don't know.
Joshua, does any of that ring familiar to you?
Wonderful. Well, I'm sorry to say, I can speak to the dynamics of that. I do not know the particular stories behind any of those little streets you mentioned. I mean, one of the things that I find fascinating about all the kind of random streets and names that sort of get left behind and then no one bothers to change them, right, is that happens all the time. You know, I think of, for example, you know, Great Jones Street downtown is a place, you know, is named after a sort of 19th century politician, but to be distinguished from Little Jones Street nearby. But then later on becomes, you know, the expression Jonesing. It's because addicts used to hang out there trying to score drugs in the 70s and became Jonesing. So all of these things, right, a sort of random name like that can become significant of other things. But gosh, I love Hangover Street. That's fabulous. Reminds me, in fact, that there's a place in the Bronx, Featherbed Lane, which our best guess as to, and that's still on the map, it's still there, our best guess as to where that comes from is that Featherbed Lane was home to bordellos that were frequented during the building of the Croton Aqueduct by workmen who built the aqueduct, and that name stuck around. But yes, as the caller sort of indicated, you know, many names obviously have to do with the sort of prominent people or worthies who lived on those streets and sort of left their names on them, and then they just became accepted. But I love too the sign north of Columbia or wherever you referenced them. I will have to look into that. Absolutely.
Let's talk to Gabe from the Upper West Side on line three. Hi, Gabe. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hey, Allison. My pleasure. Thanks so much. Yeah. So my question is related to a similar area. As far as I understand, there roughly 10-ish names for the area above 96th Street. We got Morningside Heights, Bloomingdale, Manhattanville, the Upper West Side, some people call it. How come there's so many different names for that area?
Great question.
Fabulous question. I mean, one answer there is that, right, many neighborhood names, there's a whole history, especially over recent decades of, you know, either neighborhood boosters or real estate developers or people who have a vested interest in, you know, selling property in a certain zone, you know, those names become popular. And I'm thinking especially of the kind of acronym ones with Tribecas and Sohos and Dumbos and so on. But in that area, yes, I mean, Bloemendaal, I'm invoking the Dutch origin of Bloomingdale, right? And this is sort of an antiquated name for the upper West Side, this area that you invoke. And that has a wonderful origin story, which is that in Holland, adjacent to the Harlem in Holland, in fact, to the west of Harlem there was a so-called Valley of Blooms, a kind of Valley of Flowers, named Bloemendaal, right? And so in Dutch days, that sort of name, Bloomingdale, for that part of Manhattan, dates all the way back to Dutch days, Bloomingdale being a kind of anglicization of the Dutch, Bloemendaal. So that's the origin of that. Interestingly, not related to the family who opened Bloomingdale's department store on 57th Street some centuries later. Mm-hmm. Easy to confuse those things. But, you know, sometimes these things congrue in interesting ways. But, yeah, interesting, the caller's question about just why exactly there's so many names for that neighborhood. I think many parts of the city, you know, there's sort of muddy boundary lines when we're not sure exactly, you know, where one neighborhood ends and where one begins. But I would surmise that many of those names, right, have to do with particularly community boosters sort of having an interest in renaming or sort of recoining the identity of where they are for various reasons. But anyway, just to recount the Bloomingdale story, which is a particularly mm-hmm. rich and interesting one.
Let's go to Denisa, who is calling in from Brooklyn on line 7. Hi, Denisa. Thanks for calling all of it.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a 10th great-grandfather who came over here from Amsterdam, and along with the other people that came, you know, this area became of Harlem, really, was where he had 153 acres and a farm where Harlem is now. It's funny, when they refer to the area, a lot of times they call it Horn's Hook. So I think Harlem turned out to be a much better name than instead of having it, you know, Horn's Hook be Upper Manhattan there. But yeah, he eventually lost the land then to the English when it came over.
Yeah,
but he had the first deed up there.
Denisa, thanks for the family story. Yeah, and New Amsterdam only existed for about 40 years, but the impact is so incredible, Joshua. I just say, I took my son to Holland, and we went to Harlem, and he was just, it was, you know, it's this beautiful little sailing. I mean, beautiful little sailing town, and we went to Brooklyn, and had cheese, yeah, which is because that's about all that's there, but it's striking, the footprint that the Dutch left.
Absolutely. No, and I think it's funny, too, you know, I like to think about and sort of examine why and how so many Dutch names, you know, remained, of course, but also the sort of ones that the English left behind and some that they tried to change and couldn't change. And Harlem is actually a kind of great example. You know, the English, there was a moment in the late 1600s when they tried to change the name of Harlem to Lancaster. And I would say, thank God they didn't manage, because nothing against Lancaster, but it really just doesn't have the ring. You know, the Lancaster Renaissance just wouldn't quite do it. But it's an interesting sort of process, because I think there are also many, many English, or at least English sounding place names, right, that are actually just kind of riffs on the Dutch, or at least the sort of sound of the Dutch that turned into kind of anglicized sounding names. I'm thinking, for example, of, you know, Coney Island, which in Dutch meant something. It meant Island of Rabbits. The English, it seems that they were just familiar with that name and it sounded okay, so they made it Coney Island, which doesn't mean anything in English, but it's an English-sounding word. Gramercy is another great example. Gramercy Park, you know, in Dutch days, it was the Kroo Marsh. It was a crooked marsh. You know, it had an actual descriptive function, and the Dutch just kind of took those syllables, I should say the English just took those syllables and made them Gramercy, which is a kind of English sounding word, but it just grows from the Dutch. And I think that, and obviously the Dutch, we can go on and on about Dutch place names. The Bowery, right, is meant farm road in Dutch, and it was the road that led to Peter Stuyvesant's farm, his acreage. And of course, all just the family names, the various Bleekers and all the rest, who of course are remnants or memories of New Amsterdam, right? It's not, you don't have to scratch too far beneath the surface to be reminded of the Dutch origins of New York as a European settlement and as a European town.
My guest is Joshua Jelly Shapiro. The name of the book is Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names. We have some more calls. Listeners, if you want to get in on this conversation, do you know the origin story of a specific street or neighborhood name? Maybe you have a question for Joshua. He'll do his best. 646-435-7280. We'll continue this conversation after a quick break. This is All of It. My guest is Joshua Jelly Shapiro. The name of his book is Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names. David on Twitter says, I have really appreciated the work done by @slavers of New York, who have been spreading awareness of how much of New York City is named for slaveholders. You write about this in the book. The Clarksons, Bergens, Bayards. You note that there are no fewer than 70 streets in Brooklyn named for slaveholders. What are your thoughts about what could be done with this information?
Yes. Well, no, it's a fascinating history, and I think a really promising and interesting and progressive development in the city over recent years. Just the attention that's being paid to the histories that place names can signify, and notably this history of slavery in New York. And I think that one of the reasons it's important to look at all these names that are named after people, streets, I should say, that are named after people who are engaged in the slave trade, is that New York City, we don't think of it, obviously it's in the north, we don't think of New York as having been a key sort of node in the triangle trade, or a place whose economy reaching way back, was really, if not dependent on, certainly really entwined with the economy around buying and selling people. And I think that one example to look at here in terms of what we can do is that, on Wall Street itself, which of course takes its name from being the original kind of northern wall of New Amsterdam, right? It sort of was the edge of the settlement. And Wall Street now, of course, iconic of the stock exchange and of American capitalism. But it's an amazing kind of historical fact that the main slave trading block in Manhattan in the 17th and 18th century was, in fact, at the base of Wall Street, mm-hmm. Where now it crosses Water Street, which back then, before all the fill got added, was the edge of Manhattan. And now there's a marker there that sort of, it's not huge, but it, an artist, it just sort of grew out of the Occupy movement some years ago, essentially succeeded in getting this plaque placed there. And at least it sort of reminds us and sort of tells the story of the ways in which slavery was intrinsic to the history of New York, to the history of American capitalism, certainly right there on Wall Street. And so I think that there are many ways in which we can sort of make the name speak, so to speak, and just figure out how to be engaged with the history that they signify. Obviously, there's a big sort of movement and a vital conversation now about changing certain names, and that's one that I, touch on in the book and I'm obviously engaged with, and I think there are strong arguments for changing certain names, but it's also, of course, a complex question about making those names, again, having them allow us to understand our history, not efface it. And so, anyway, that's a long and complex conversation, but I'm one, absolutely, as someone who is both fascinated by names and cares deeply about using them as a way to understand our past and ourselves, that what's happened in Brooklyn, for example, is you mentioned that now there's awareness that there are no fewer than 70 streets in Brooklyn that are named after people who own slaves or were engaged in the trade in some way. And that awareness is vital. It's important. And I think that we need to keep engaging that history and figure out ways to make it speak to our present and to the present that we want to have and the just society we want to live.
You know, I spent some time down there, and it's really poignant. Sometimes people will leave flowers at the slave mart. I've seen people leave flowers
totally.
Next to the, yeah. the plaque.
Exactly.
Alexander yep. on Twitter says, one of my favorite street name stories is to learn that Irving Ave in Ridgewood is named for Washington Irving, Sleepy Hollow author, and that nearby Knickerbocker Ave yeah. was named for a term he popularized. Let's go to Tony, who's calling in from Key West, but also lives in Brooklyn. You've got your New York uh-huh. friend, Tony. Hi, Tony. Thanks for holding.
Well, thank you. This is a little bit more mundane, but we live on St. Mark's Avenue in the double-digit block of St. Mark's Avenue in Brooklyn. It starts out as Wyckoff to the east in Cobble Hill, and at 3rd Avenue, it becomes St. Mark's Place. At 5th Avenue, mm-hmm. the name changes to St. Mark's Avenue, but the numbers start all over again. So mail that goes to 22 St. Mark's Place ends up at our house and vice versa. And we become very conversant and intimate mm-hmm. with the people who have the same numbers. And we've researched it. We can't figure out what those name changes represent, especially since they're so illogical.
Yeah, that's fascinating to hear about. And I've heard, especially in Brooklyn, there are some examples of this. And one thing to say about that is that, of course, that custom of a street, you know, changing its name every block or every few blocks, you know, if you go to London today, if you go to England, that's still the way the city is, which is why London, you know, is kind of incredibly impossible to navigate for those who aren't from there, don't have the A to Z map guide with them. And it's an interesting history that in Manhattan, at least after the Revolutionary War, there was a concerted effort to essentially kind of do away with that old English custom and create a much more rational, navigable system of streets and addresses. And obviously the one place that's perhaps not the case still, right, is in the Village, which predates the grid and predates that sort of effort at rationalization. But it's interesting, and there were, analogous efforts in Brooklyn, sort of reorderings of Brooklyn streets at various moments in the 19th century, and sort of changing names whole cloth and laying out new subdivisions and so on. But I mean, it seems that you live on one of those streets that escaped that process of rationalization, if you like, and recalls how things still are, as I say, in London and other cities across the sea.
Let's go to Mary on line 4, calling in from Queens. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling All of It.
Thank you for this fascinating discussion. Here in Elmhurst, Queens, we have a wonderful name, Justice Avenue. And I was wondering if Joshua could shed any light on its origins.
Thanks, Mary.
Justice Avenue. I wish I could. I'm trying. I remember encountering that tale, and it's not at the tip of my tongue. But there are, you know, it's wonderful. I think Queens in particular has many, many streets that are, we haven't even gotten to the sort of history of honorary street names and second street names, which have exploded mm-hmm. over recent decades. But many places just sort of named for abstract nouns. And Justice is one there. Utopia Parkway is one that I love, right? Utopia being obviously, as we know, the sort of idea of a place that in fact literally doesn't exist. That's the Greek origin of it, right? Utopia. But the reason that's a poignant one is that it actually was meant to go to a housing development that was meant to be built at some point in the early 20th century, and was going to allow Jews and other people who were excluded from some of the other new racially exclusive housing developments out there. Sadly, the developer ran out of money, and so the Utopia Village that was meant to be built never did, but the street remains, and there are many sort of examples of that, of places that are coined by developers or coined by other creators of neighborhoods and settlements, and their names are still there.
Before I let you go, you know, we've talked so much about history and the history of street names from hundreds of years ago. What about modern street naming? You sort of alluded to it in your last answer about all of the secondary street names. There really was kind of an explosion of them. Why?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. This is actually goes back to something we discussed a few minutes ago about what's unique about New York. And New York is, in fact, sort of uniquely liberal or prolific, if you like, in what it allows in terms of secondary or honorary street names. There was a law that was passed in 1992 called Local Law 28, which allows city council, it basically sort of expedited and made it easier to add these second names to streets. Before that, obviously, we'd had some sort of name changes. Avenue of the Americas, Mayor LaGuardia got pushed through, and there's some streets in the Bronx named for various Yankees and so on. But that moment, you know, basically the people who tend to the city map, which they still keep on these huge Mylar sheets, you know, didn't want to have to actually change names, but it allowed city council people to honor local citizens, to honor prominent New Yorkers or people in histories who it seems that it would be nice to honor. And I think through the 90s, it, you know, it was a few dozen a year was happening. And then, honestly, the big sort of rise in those after 9/11, many, you know, local politicians and city councilors used the opportunity to memorialize those who lost their lives, you know, on September 11th, 2001. And after that, since that, we've had, you know, it became essentially something that city council did. I think it's basically, if I'm not mistaken, up to a fourth of every actual single local law passed now goes to adding a honorary second street name. And they are a wonderful kind of second order geography to the city. You know, ice cream vendors and obviously celebrities, but also just local beloved people, you know. And so that's a whole other story. There's a wonderful website called oldstreets.com where a man called Gilbert Tauber has compiled a list of all the honorary street names and keeps up with them. Otherwise, we'd have them not in one place. But you know, Allison, I wanted just to say one other thing about sort of modern street names and sort of reckoning with history, and that's just a quick anecdote from Southern Brooklyn, which is there's a place there called Corbin Place, which is in the sort of Brighton Beach, Manhattan Beach area. And it's named for the developer, the sort of wealthy man in the late 19th century who developed those neighborhoods, Austin Corbin. And it came to the attention of local residents and others, you know, about 20 years ago, and obviously earlier for those who studied him, but it became a topic of conversation that he was a real sort of violent anti-Semite. You know, mm-hmm. He was an active member of this organization for the suppression of Jews, you know, this nasty, offensive history that this man had. And I think that the solution that people in that part of Brooklyn came up with was sort of inspired, which was to, in fact, not change the name of Corbin Place, because people have memories there. They have identities tied to that place and perhaps happy memories, and it's a part of who they are. But instead, they just added a single letter. They now call it, it's now officially M. Corbin Place, and that is to honor Margaret Corbin, who is a prominent, perhaps the most prominent woman participant in the American Revolutionary War in New York. So a different kind of hero. And essentially, I think it's a wonderful way to kind of get around this issue of, well, these names mean different things to different people. And Corbin signified something awful that we wanted to get past, but they kept the street name and celebrate a different history. So that's a wonderful kind of little tale from the last few years.
That's what we call a workaround. The name of the book is Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names. My guest has been Joshua Jelly Shapiro. Thanks for being with us, Joshua.
Thanks so much. Pleasure.